Welcome to Your Call. I'm Angie Carter. Rose Aguilar is on vacation. Yesterday, Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock defeated Republican football star and business owner Herschel Walker in the Georgia runoff election. It was tight, but it was decisive, with a hair over half the vote going to Warnock. It was roughly 51-49%. Tight or not, Warner conceded before the night was over. Warnock's win secures a crucial 51st Senate seat for the Democrats. That victory comes despite the impact of voter suppression laws put in place by Governor Brian Kemp in March of 2021. Those laws cut down the runoff voting period from 9 weeks to only 4. It barred organizers from registering new voters in the early voting period. Senate Bill 202 also cut down on the number of drop boxes in black communities. An NPR analysis found 1.9 million voters, many of them voters of color, saw their travel time to a drop box spike significantly after that was passed. On today's Your Call, we'll speak with two organizers who were on the ground in Georgia throughout the runoff election to discuss what it took to make this victory happen. How have organizers reached out to voters and worked around these harsh voter suppression laws? And from the national perspective, what does this victory mean for the Democrats' ability to get legislation through Congress? Joining us to discuss the topic, Helen Butler. She's executive director of the Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda, an advocacy organization founded in 1998. It fights for voting rights protections, criminal justice reform, elimination of barriers to the ballot box, right on point today, quality education, affordable housing, and equal participation in the political process for Georgians of color and underrepresented communities. Helen, thanks for making time.
Well, thank you, Angie, for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you.
I can imagine you're doing a lot of smiling today. I can hear it.
Oh, yes, I am doing a lot of smiling because of the turnout was astronomical, and we are so happy about that.
Oh, we're going to find out how you did that. In fact, we're going to get similar information from Wanda Mosley. She's National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. That organization works to build black political power. Yesterday, Wanda traveled to various precincts in the Atlanta metro area to get the vote out. She joins us from South Fulton, Georgia. Wanda, all smiles over there, too?
Absolutely. All smiles about what we saw yesterday. And also being here in this same virtual space with one of my mentors who I look up to greatly, Ms. Helen Butler from the Coalition of People's Agenda.
Excellent. Glad to put you two together again. John Nichols is with us, too, our frequent guest, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and author of several books, including Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. John, welcome back.
Angie, it's great to be with you and great to be with Wanda and Helen.
And of course, you listening are an important part of the discussion. I imagine you have some strong feelings about the election result. Please join us on our phone lines, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Helen, you and your organization were involved in a lawsuit yesterday to keep the polls open in Henry County in Georgia. And that is sort of emblematic as to the kind of fights you've had to keep fighting to get a fair vote. Tell me about why that lawsuit was necessary. What was going on?
Well, Angie, yesterday, you know, we were all ready and set to begin the voting process. And of course, in Henry County, none of the election equipment was working. Voters were standing in line at 6 a.m. and the polls don't open until 7. So a lot of voters were turned away. They weren't given them any instructions. And we had to file a lawsuit to keep it open on the back end because so many people were turned away and were not able to exercise their right to vote while they stood in line from 6 to 7 because they had to go to work.
Right.
So that's things that we had to make sure that their votes would count and that they could have the opportunity to say who gets to represent them. That's why we filed the lawsuit. And I'm so happy to be working with Wanda, my Sara, and friend in this fight in Georgia.
Wanda, let's take a look at what happened there with trying to keep the polls open to get those people who did have to go to work to get them back there. And it's hard enough to get people to get out and vote the first time. And if you discourage them on the spot with the machines just feet away, there's a chance you're not going to get them back. And that doesn't sound entirely like it's not by design. Wanda?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are many circumstances and contributing factors to whether or not folks are even going to be able to come out the first time to vote. You know, our state still has a minimum wage for a certain class of companies that is only $5.15 an hour. And even if you think about the federal minimum wage being just over $7 an hour, that's not a lot of money. So we have created a situation with the long lines that come from, as Ms. Helen mentioned, inadequate equipment at polling sites, a lack of training for poll workers, and not having enough poll workers, you know, during this pandemic that we are still in, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so you couple that with the reality of not being in a country where a state where we have a livable wage. And that's another layer, another barrier for voters. And then you add on top all of the other situations that have been legislated to keep folks from coming to the polling precinct. And on top of that, the inability for us to offer comfort to folks as they stand in line. And thank goodness it never got to that point. But even thinking about the Secretary of State's abilities being gutted, the legislature implementing all these other policies, having people appointed to boards of election, and then giving and stripping power at that level. So there's a lot that still needs to be addressed and fixed here in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the things that we push back on mightily is this idea that just because we continue to have record turnout, that does not mean voter suppression does not exist in our state. That is a testament to the determination and the resilience of Georgia voters.
Helen, let me go back to you. And I may sound naive, but I'm going to ask you to be something of a mind reader. When these kind of laws pass that you can't bring people in line pizza and water, you literally can't bring people water in line while they wait in long lines to vote. It's hard to imagine that anyone is naive enough to say this has been passed to keep the vote fair and accessible. This will keep the voting booth open to all with an adequate amount of time. It's posited that way. It's posited that these regulations are put in place to make the vote a fairer thing. Does anyone actually believe that, Helen?
No, other than the people that passed the law, perhaps, may think that. But I don't even think that they think that. It was put in place based on a lie that there was fraud, that there were things were done incorrectly. And that's not true. We have over 500 election officials that really come to work every day to make sure that our elections are accessible and fair. Yeah, it's not always right. I can tell you that. As Wanda said, you know, there's a lot of training that goes in place, but these laws were put in place as barriers, even to the extent that people were intimidated and harassed for doing their jobs. And so our legislature decided that they wanted to really, as they quote, call it, give it integrity, when in fact the Secretary of State had been all before that time talking about how great and what quality our election systems had. We were rated number 3 in terms of access, and now we're rated down at the bottom almost. So it was there. These are barriers that were there not to solve any problem, but they are creating problems. If you look at the runoff election itself, from 9 weeks to 4 weeks, they had to certify an election. Election officials had to certify an election. They had to do a risk-limiting audit and then get the machines ready, then do a logic and accuracy testing, do the proper notification. And it actually boiled down to the voters had 1 week of early voting, which is unheard of. Mm-hmm. And it really created a great barrier for people to be able to exercise vote by mail. It was non-existent. So people who were disabled, people who could not be around, like Wanda said, COVID is still here, as well as the new flu variant. Mm-hmm. So people are still being impacted and couldn't be around people, but they had to actually show up to vote in person because of this draconian law, SB 202, that was put in place. But our voters said, despite the barriers that you put in place, we're going to find workarounds and we're going to make sure that they get to exercise that right to vote. I know for us, for people with the ID, providing IDs, and you had to have a copying machine. Older people didn't have that. They didn't know how to make pictures and of their IDs and attach. Well, we provided the equipment for them to do that. So we're going to find those ways to work around. But again, it is voter suppression. It wasn't just easy to show up with record turnout numbers. We had to really work and expend a lot of resources that could have been used for other things.
Helen Butler, I know you have to go. I'm really glad we had you at least for these few minutes. And I congratulate you again. I know it was a lot of hard work and it paid off. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Helen Butler, Executive Director of the Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda. Staying with us, Wanda Mosley, National Field Director for Black Voters Matter, and John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. John, I want to put this in a national context because there is a case before the Supreme Court right now. It's an effort to reserve regulation of federal races within a state to that state itself. As David Liptak explained at the New York Times, it would give state legislators enormous, largely unchecked power to set all sorts of election rules, notably by drawing congressional maps warped by partisan gerrymandering. And at least four of the conservative judges have already indicated they're looking at this with some favors. John, talking about SB 202 and then talking about this, it's all the same thing, ultimately.
Sure. It's all part of the same kind of massive strategy on the part of a political party that has gone to such extremes that it is no longer viable in a fair fight. And so you have folks within the Republican Party, not the whole Republican Party. I'll acknowledge there are some Republicans who are ill at ease with this strategy, but certainly folks in a lot of positions of power who have determined that the way to win elections is by gaming the process. And this is incredibly destructive and dangerous stuff. It's been well illustrated by the good comments from Wanda and Helen here. It's also something that is very unpopular. Understand that despite all the voter suppression efforts and everything that's been going on, Republicans have now had three losing election cycles, 2018, 2020, 2022, which last night's result further confirms. And so there's a discomfort with this, and yet there's a clear desire to go forward with it. And the really troubling aspect of it all is what you just pointed to, this Supreme Court deliberation. Because one of the things that needs to be understood is that there has always been a lot of gray area as regards the power of the states in determining how to proceed with federal elections. And as a result, we already have a horrible system in the United States where, for instance, in Georgia, to get elected to the United States Senate, right, in the last 2 years, Raphael Warnock has had to win four elections. He had to win the general election of 2020, the runoff election of 2021, the general election of 2022, and the later runoff later 2022 runoff election that occurred yesterday. That doesn't happen in other states. In most states, you win an election, you go and sit in the Senate, right?
Right.
And so we have different rules already from state to state. If it's encouraged, if this process is encouraged more, if you develop more of a variety of rules, that becomes an altogether more problematic circumstance. And then here's where it gets really significant. I wrote a book a number of years ago about the Florida fiasco in 2020, the Bush v. Gore fight. One of the lost realities of that fight was that as the recounts and the processes of reviewing the votes carried forward, a process that I believe would have done right and done fairly have confirmed Al Gore's victory in the state, the members of the Republican-controlled state legislature proposed to simply shut the process down and send their own set of electors up to Washington in favor of Bush to disregard what the result was. We need to understand that because of, you know, gray areas in our Constitution and because of potentially this Supreme Court ruling, you could have a situation as soon as 2024 where a state legislature in a state that was carried by the Democrat might choose to send a set of Republican electors to Washington. If that happens, we're in a chaotic crisis situation that really, frankly, could make January 6th, 2021 look, you know, like a lesser crisis than what might be coming.
Ouch. Wanda Mosley, I want to take this back to you because talking about obstruction to voting, Washington Post had an article that Georgia's runoff system was created to dilute black voting power, created in 1964 after the urging of a powerful segregationist. And now, of course, we're in the situation that we have where we had this very close election yesterday. But the runoff system isn't used in every state. In Georgia, it seems to have worked in as a companion barrier to all of the SB 202 problems. So the runoff system itself might be flawed. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Absolutely. It is just another tool in the war chest of those who do not believe in or respect the democracy of the United States, the democratic process, the idea, the notion of one person, one vote, that every citizen of this country should have a say in how our country is governed, whether it's the local level, county, state, or federal level. And so that is a system that, as you pointed out, we've lived in, you know, longer than I've been alive in Georgia. And it's very frustrating. It is, you know, part and parcel to a lot of systems that are in place that are intended to keep black and brown people home on election day and to make it harder for us to come out and vote. I was a part of a lawsuit that was filed in the summer of 2020, where myself and some colleagues, and this is independent of my role at Black Voters Matter, but myself and some colleagues got together and said that we wanted to challenge the way that our state administers the Public Service Commission races here in Georgia. Mm-hmm. We have five districts. We have a map that is drawn to create these five districts, but every person across the state votes for each of those seats. It causes confusion among voters. And more importantly, our claim was that this system also waters down, it dilutes the black vote. And there was very strong evidence to support that. The most glaring being the fact that the seat that is drawn for the metro area, which is the most diverse part of our state, we've never had a preferred candidate that black voters like ever take that seat. And to also add, you know, insult to injury to me, which was also just more fact for the judge to consider, is each person who had been elected to that seat as it was drawn for the metro area, none of those commissioners had ever won any of the counties in the metro area. They were never victorious. They were never able to win to get more votes in any of those metro counties. And that is because the way that you administer this race dilutes black voters. I can say that we were successful in this bid. This decision was challenged up to the Supreme Court. We were successful at all levels. The 11th Circuit as well agreed, but then the Supreme Court shot that down. And so in this last election cycle in November, we did not have the public service seat on the ballot here in Georgia. And so now our state legislature is challenged with coming up with a more equitable system that the judge will approve or disapprove moving forward to elect public service commissioners in the state of Georgia.
We're talking today on Your Call about the election, the winning of the runoff election by Senator Raphael Warnock, who retains his seat in the Senate. If you would like to contribute to the hour, you are more than welcome. The phone lines are open at 866-798-8255. John Nichols, how did it come to this in the first place? We have a guy who was a football player, business owner, no experience in politics, whose claim to fame is that he wants to be a werewolf and not a vampire. And if nobody knows, if somebody doesn't recognize that, it's an example of his weird, weird disconnected rhetoric at public appearances. How did we get to a point where someone like that gets half the vote?
Well, look, Georgia is a very conservative southern state that is evolving, right? That is progressing. At least that's my view. Some people might disagree with me. And so it is moving toward a much more competitive politics. But look, one has to understand that we have moved into, in this country, a political cycle. Well, an extended political cycle in which partisanship is so intense that members of both political parties are willing to accept candidates who are highly flawed because they see the election of their candidate, the winning of that seat, which may not give them a majority, as so essential. And this is a much more pronounced reality within the Republican Party than within the Democratic Party. People need to understand how Herschel Walker came to be the Republican nominee. He wasn't the choice of grassroots Georgia Republicans. He was initially the choice of Donald Trump, who went around and found celebrities who he thought would be good candidates for the United States Senate. He liked celebrities because they came from outside of politics and tended to be more loyal to him and to his approach than they were understanding of traditional political processes. So Walker was imposed on Republicans in Georgia. There were some Republicans who supported him, no question of that. But would he have been the likely candidate if Trump had not come along? I don't think so. And so you ended up in this situation with this candidate who then turned out to be, as you well point out, stunningly flawed. And instead of acknowledging that, and by the way, they could have acknowledged that early enough so that they could have gotten another candidate. But instead of acknowledging that as the process went on, Republicans just dug in deeper. And it's important to understand that in the final stages of this election fight in Georgia, you had sitting United States senators, people like Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, coming into Florida, standing at the side of Herschel Walker, saying, "This guy's got to be in the U.S. Senate." Were they doing so because they thought Herschel Walker would be a great U.S. senator? Sadly, I don't think so. I think they were doing so because they just so desperately wanted that seat. And this is something that I think has begun to be referred to as a win at any cost politics. I've got a big piece in The Nation this week, actually, which looks at how the Republican Party has evolved to a point now where not only will they make excuses for candidates who are, far outside the realm of credible, but they will also, as we're talking about in this show today, dismantle and disregard democracy. Then, and one thing to understand is that at recent CPAC conferences, the big conservative political action conferences that they have every year, some of the recent top speakers have been people like Viktor Orban from Hungary and the new leader of Italy, who comes out of a historically neo-fascist party. And so we see in the Republican Party a movement away from respect for democracy. And it's haunting folks in Georgia. Frankly, I think it's haunting folks across the country.
Yeah, I think you're right. Wanda, to take this over to you, there was a CNN poll, and it said that, and this was before the election day, Warnock supporters, it said, broadly say they're casting ballots to support their candidate, 83% of them, rather than to oppose Walker, 17%. But among the others, those who favored Walker, 52% said their vote was to support him, but a full 47% said they're voting against the other guy. Is this consistent with what you saw on the ground?
Absolutely. I think John raised so many good points, and I'm interested in reading your piece too, to get some more insights. I think that this was at its worst, an example of where we are in this country with regards to our political climate. The tribalism is just gone too far. I think that, we all saw at the surface, just all the glaring issues with why Herschel Walker was not a good candidate and why he was not qualified to hold a seat in the United States Senate. He was put forth as a puppet. he was a pawn in a larger game that the Republican Party is playing. And I would also offer that, you know, there are some issues with regard to white supremacy and racism that we should discuss in this particular race. You know, Herschel Walker was handpicked for all the reasons that John said, but also he was put forth as a likable person to give the Republican Party an opportunity to claim and to scream that they're not racist, that they embrace the Black community and they want Black people to be a part of their party. And that's simply not true. We know that this was an attempt to subvert another Black man, to pit Black people against Black people, and to give, again, white people an opportunity to weigh in on how they feel and where that they think they want their party to go. And so putting forth this, again, ridiculously underqualified candidate who spent time talking about zombies and werewolves when nearly 1.5 million people in our state don't have health care. Mm-hmm. And that is an act of our Republican controlled state legislature. But as you are here running for this Senate seat, you are now in lockstep and embraced by the same GOP party that is not giving us what we need in terms of just some of our basic needs in our state. And so I have to say, quite frankly, I believe putting him forth as a candidate was offensive. Not only was it strategically a disaster, it was also offensive as a Black woman living in the state of Georgia.
That's Wanda Mosley, National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. And we're going to go to the phones as soon as we take a quick break here. Pat in San Francisco, hold that phone line because you're going to be next as soon as we come back here on Your Call. I'm Angie Carro in for the vacationing Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. I'm Angie Carro. We're talking about the election runoff in Georgia last night. And as promised, Pat in San Francisco, we're going to you on the phone lines. Pat, welcome.
Good morning, Angie. Thanks so much for this very timely conversation. You've got some really good guests, and we're learning a lot about this, but I still have two quick questions. Mm-hmm. First of all, how could so many Georgia voters, a very large minority of Georgia voters, not be able to distinguish between a competent sitting senator and someone who had zero qualifications for the office? How could that be? How could so many people support him? And secondly, is it legal for someone who lives in Texas to run for the Senate in Georgia?
There's the big elephant in the room, so to speak. Pat, hang on to that. Hang on to that thought, because we had been touching on how he was posited as Walker was posited as a reasonable candidate. But Wanda, you're the one who was on the ground talking to people. And I'm imagining that you and the people you worked with ended up talking to people who genuinely told you why they were voting for Walker. Is that an accurate assumption? And what did they say to you about why they would vote for him?
You know, I think that right now the Republican Party, they have pretty much, you know, embraced one or two policies, issues that they are going to hang their hat on, no matter what polling might suggest the American public is actually worried about or things that Americans actually want to see move forward. Republicans are hell-bent on protecting guns and abortion and ending abortion in this country. And so those are the two things that they wanted to hang their hat on. Herschel Walker was a means to an end for those goals. And so that is the only reason why people were voting for him. I honestly cannot say that I have encountered or heard or saw anyone say that he is qualified and that's my guy. That's the person I want representing me. People would often pivot back to those issues and those things that they wanted to see happen to further their party's agenda. And then, you know, that's where we are in Georgia. And Georgia is a microcosm of the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. And if and until the minority, as you say, as the caller stated, can get their minds right and see the bigger picture of the things that we need to accomplish to move our country forward, we are in trouble. We are in big trouble in these United States.
John Nichols, let's tackle the second half of Pat's question, and that is the whole idea of someone who doesn't live there running for Senate.
Well, of course, that is a very big issue. Look, we have bizarrely inconsistent laws around the United States, as we talked about in other areas of this conversation, as regards residency requirements. And in Georgia, they got around it, apparently, despite the fact that that there's simply no question that Herschel Walker acknowledged in conversation that he had been resident in Texas for, you know, much of the time before he became a contender. Look, this is, again, I think it needs to be understood as part of this win at any cost approach. You know, historically, political parties have understood that they need credible candidates who have roots in their communities that know where they're running. As we've nationalized our politics, a lot of that has gone by the wayside. And if I can just take one piece of the earlier part of
Pat's question.
And I would say, when she says, how could people vote for such a bad candidate? Well, you know, again, what we need to understand is that we have a lot of states in this country that are, you know, have historically been non-competitive, right? They are so in the camp of one political party that they're going to vote for the candidate of that party no matter what. What's exciting about Georgia is that it's become competitive. And this is a relatively rare thing in modern American politics. It's happened in Arizona as well, where we've seen states that just a few years ago, it would have been almost unimaginable that Democrats would be winning statewide. They are now winning statewide. And what we ought to think about is not how close the election result was, as frustrating as it may be to some people, but about the reality that these election results are going in a different direction than they historically would have. Remember, Georgia now has a Jewish United States senator and a Black United States senator, both of whom vote, by and large, with the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party. If I had told you that was going to 10 years ago that that was going to be a reality, I don't think you would have believed me.
John, I want to pick up on something you said in there. A lot of analyses this morning are saying that Georgia has now more or less officially turned purple. Is that overstating it?
Well, I think Wanda might have some thoughts on that as well. look, I can tell you from a national perspective that Georgia's been purple for quite a while. Stacey Abrams, ran a tremendous campaign for governor in 2018, came very close to winning. In fact, the results were actually disputed because it was so close. In 2020, Joe Biden won Georgia by a very small margin, but he won it. And in the runoffs, you had John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock win in 2021. 2022, Warnock is reelected. So clearly, at the statewide level, Georgia is purple. But it's also, you know, important to understand that it's still a very, very tough state. And what we now have, if we look, Angie, around the country, we've got six or seven of these states that are just incredibly competitive. They are closely divided. Georgia's one of them, I think, at this point. I think Arizona's one of them. Wisconsin, my home state, is clearly one of them. I think it's fair to say Pennsylvania and a couple others, Nevada. And this is going to become a reality of our politics going forward. These states are going to see incredibly intense, incredibly competitive elections. And those states that I just mentioned are going to be the central states to the 2024 presidential election, in which everything that we're talking about today, voter suppression, the deep divisions, the win at any cost approach, are all going to come into play. Anybody who thinks that, you know, we've kind of, you know, moved out of the difficult moments in our politics, I think is missing the reality. We are very much in an extended period in our history where we're just going to have a group of states that are, yes, purple, but, you know, for more realistic terminology, are intensely competitive and very vulnerable, where there's going to be a lot of pressure on their election systems and on their election processes. And some of that pressure will include voter suppression.
We're going to get back to the phones in just a moment. But as John suggested, Wanda, I want to get your take on this as well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like many other states in the South and other parts of the country, we have been subjected to some extreme gerrymandering. So there's just no way that progressive minded folks are going to have any say in how our state is run right now. Our state house, our state senate, our state legislature is going to be, you know, as it's drawn in the maps, basically. And sadly, that's the same in terms of the U.S. House, our representation there as well. But, you know, look, we are able to win seats and build power at the local level in spite of the new voter suppression laws that were signed in 2021. We actually had a lot of wins at the local level in terms of our municipal races and even at some of the county levels in 2021, in the fall of 2021. We picked up something like 30 or so seats in terms of the grassroots partner organizations that we work with at Black Voters Matter here in Georgia. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing some shifts and some changes. And I think it's also important for us to remind voters, to remind residents that when we are able to have power at the local level, there are things that our local elected officials can do to protect us, to offer us levels of protection. So, for example, there was an executive order issued by the mayor of Atlanta in 2020 where she stated that Atlanta police would not be arresting anyone who violated any of the voter suppression laws in terms of passing out snacks and water. We also saw across the country earlier this year in the summer, a group of district attorneys who signed on to letters saying that they would not prosecute healthcare providers for providing women the life-saving needed healthcare that they required. So building power at the local level has always been a focus for us at Black Voters Matter. Mm-hmm. And we are still seeing a lot of that power and a lot of wins at that level. But for now, you know, we're going to keep fighting at the state and the federal level. And, you know, as time goes by, we'll start to see some shifts and some changes there. Like we did in 2020 in the sixth congressional district seat that flipped Democrat for the first time, I think, ever, a seat that had once been held by Newt Gingrich and then was won by Lucy McBath.
There's a change for you. Wanda Mosley and John Nichols are with us, and we have Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, you've been waiting quite a while. I really appreciate that. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. A couple of things. I'm delighted that Warnock won in Georgia, but don't forget that the Republicans control the House, and we'll see what happens with that zoo when they return in January. Two quick points I'll try to make. I was trying to figure out last night why the Republicans decided to go with Walker, and I'll just throw this out to your guests, and I just want to make one other quick point. I don't know if this is even true, but it seemed to me that maybe some thinking on the part of the Republicans was that, look, we'll put up another black man to run against Warnock, hoping that we can divide the black vote, and since the white vote in Georgia may be more conservative, that might be a way to win that seat, and it was a close race. So I think it'd be very interesting to see the sort of racial and ethnic breakdown on the votes after sort of the post-mortem. My third point.
That's okay. No problem, Greg. Hang on for that, and we'll get to your third point. Wanda, I want to get your sense about whether there was a black vote for Herschel Walker and what rationale there was for that.
Yeah, no, John actually makes a really good point. There has been a real concerted effort by the GOP here in Georgia to start to pick off votes, in particular from black men. They see an opportunity because there is a thought, prevailing thought among Democrats and among some folks that there has been, the Democratic Party has expanded and become all inclusive. We're at a time where obviously black women have been the most consistent and loyal voting bloc for the Democratic Party at the national level for decades. We also know that the Democratic Party has expanded to include a lot of our LGBTQ plus members of our community. And so there's an idea, there are whispers, there's a campaign, a concerted effort for the GOP to say to black men that there's no place for you in the Democratic Party. I mean, my organization is nonpartisan, so I don't want to get too much into party politics, mm-hmm. but you are seeing the idea of seeing Black men as vulnerable in the form of a Herschel Walker, a football star, someone widely popular among white people, but also someone who would look like the opponent. And so giving also, again, as I mentioned earlier, the GOP cover an opportunity to say that their party is not racist, that they don't not like Black people, but both of those things are true. And so putting forth Herschel Walker as a pawn was something that, you know, that they strategized and thought would be a good idea on some level. Now, we know mainly the state GOP did not want him as a candidate, but we saw them get in line and fully support him, especially for this runoff effort. You know, again, leaning back into this whole idea of tribalism and the issues that are important to their party.
John, let's pick up on the other part of the question, and that was an allusion to what it is going to be like with the House in the hands of the Republicans and the Senate in the hands of the Democrats. And of course, there's a Democratic White House right now. So are we looking at a logjam of things, or are we looking at a Democratic Party that might have the strength to revisit some earlier issues that they had lost on?
Are you looking at a logjam? I'm not going to lie. Sorry. You know, look, they continue to have their majority in the House through the end of the year. And so theoretically, they could do some things. But you still have the reality in the Senate where Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin are a barrier to decisive action there. So, look, the Democrats were dealt a tough hand in 2020 with the very narrow majority in the Senate. They've been dealt a slightly tougher hand now because they don't have control of one of the chambers. And even if their Republican control is narrow, and it is very narrow, the Republicans will have the ability to do two things. One, launch investigations, which will distract from the process of governing, and they're promising to do that by any measure. And two, far more importantly, to say no. Through the budget process and through other processes, they can simply refuse to go along with initiatives that the president wants, that the Democrats in the Senate want. And that's a reality of our political system, Angie. And it's really one that we ought to pause and recognize. We have a political system where even when you get a decisive result in one direction, it can be tripped up just by realities that Wanda was just mentioning, things like gerrymandering, things like money in politics. The reality is that the 2022 election was a major victory for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. This is a midterm election when they were supposed to lose a lot of seats to be really set back. Instead, they gained a seat in the United States Senate. Biden is the first president since Franklin Roosevelt in 1934 to see all of the senators from his party who were on the ballot reelected. That is, it's historically almost unprecedented. He is one of the first presidents, Democratic presidents in modern history to see significant improvements in the position in the states in a midterm election. And the House elections proved to be dramatically closer. If the Democrats had just had a slightly better strategy on things like Social Security, they would have kept the House. So we know where the American people are at. Unfortunately, the American people are not going to get the government that they signal that they wanted. And so as a result, we're going to have 2 years of gridlock. And the real question is what Democrats will do in that gridlock moment. They can look for avenues where they might be able to pass some legislation. Remember, there's a couple of reasonable Republicans in the House. Not a lot of them, but a couple, and maybe they can move things in a better direction on a particular issue. But really, I think what you're talking about is something that Senator Bernie Sanders has talked about, and that is taking the show on the road, going out to the American people, talking mm-hmm. about what they want to do, what they would do if they had a majority in the House and a bigger majority in the Senate and holding the presidency, and frankly, acknowledging the reality that the 2024 presidential election has already begun.
We're going to try to get two more questions in here. Greg in Palo Alto, if you can keep it brief, did you come up with your other question?
Yes, I did. And maybe you've covered this, so maybe you can move on. But my question is really, I wonder what challenges, legal challenges, were made to SB, 20, in Georgia, and were any successful? I mean, it seems to me that some of these voter suppression tactics are so blatantly discriminatory. that courts would have a hard time upholding them. I mean, criminalizing people providing food or water to people standing in line for hours.
In fact, if I can take that over to Wanda, thank you for that, Greg. I take that over to Wanda, and you had said that there was just a judge who refused to enforce that, so the food and water was there. But where do legal challenges to 202 stand now?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we find ourselves in a time and age where we no longer have protection from the court system. The federal courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court, are not giving us what we used to be able to rely on. And so those challenges, we have not been successful in that. As of right now, it is still criminal to offer food and water for folks standing in line. But I think, you know, the thing that worries me the most is the subversion taking away power from the Secretary of State, who is a statewide elected official, and then giving the legislature power to make changes at the county level with our boards of election. You know, Georgia is unique in that we have 159 counties, so we're second only to Texas in terms of the number of counties that we have. So we have 159 boards of election, and there are there's some leeway, and there are decisions that are made at the county level. And the system that we've always operated in is that those appointed positions come from, you know, offer some balance. But now we're at a point where we are giving the legislature, which right now is GOP controlled, more ability to pick and choose who sits on these boards. And as we all know, from the infamous phone call, these are the people who certify elections. And so stripping power and making that those decisions now be based on party affiliation is very dangerous and very scary for the future of elections in Georgia. And so, you know, we're looking at what the Supreme Court is talking about today in their oral arguments. But we also know that we now live in an era since the gutting of the Voting Rights Act and the removal of preclearance, that this is a reality that we are having to live with in Georgia. And so you're right, John, you would think that these things that are so obviously egregious and biased and discriminatory could be solved by the court system. But the court system in this country is no longer blind, in my opinion.
Let's just sneak on over to San Francisco and talk to Frank. Frank, thank you for waiting. You're on your call.
Yeah, I was wondering, is it true that one of the provisions of the voter suppression laws was that you could challenge any voter in the state of Georgia, and that in Greg Palast's latest film, he has a scene where he's talking to this Republican, I don't know what she was in one county, and he claimed that she had challenged 30,000 voters, and I'd like to know if any of those people who were challenged got to vote yesterday or had their vote counted.
And we'll take Wanda. I'm going to stay with you on that. Is that a familiar tale?
Yeah, no. So he's absolutely right. We are in a time and place in Georgia where individuals can come in and challenge, you know, the legitimacy of someone's registration. We saw just in September, there was a huge challenge. I can't remember the exact number. If it was 30,000 or, you know, something insane like that, the number of people who were challenged in Gwinnett County. And it's no coincidence that this huge challenge happened in Gwinnett because it is our most diverse county in the entire state. It is majority minority. People of color outnumber white voters in Gwinnett. And so we saw these challenges. We've seen challenges in numerous counties across the state. I don't want to say that, you know, it's just Gwinnett County. Mm-hmm. But thus far, so far, everything has worked out in our favor and people have not been removed from the voting rolls. But what this also does is it causes a drain on the at the county level. It's a drain on resources. It's a drain on time. It's also meant to intimidate folks. And so you think about our state is quite diverse in terms of, because we do have a large agriculture business here in Georgia. We have a lot of migrant workers. So it's meant to intimidate those folks. It's meant to intimidate people who live in mixed households, where there are some people who are citizens and some whose status is still in flux. So that is another unfortunate piece to that voter suppression bill. So it is it's a very scary time in Georgia when you think about elections and politics. We are in a lot of ways on thin ice on a lot of policies, and we have got to start figuring out how we're going to get protections from the people who are elected to serve us.
Wanda Mosley. John Nichols, I'm going to toss you the last question. I have about 60 seconds for you to get it in here.
Sure.
This has been seen as something of a failure for Donald Trump, but the Washington Post pointed out, what compels a person to shower in gasoline and light up a cigar? In Walker's case, he came into the orbit of that serial destroyer of other people's reputations, Donald Trump. Is that fair? Because Politico breaks it down and says almost half the candidates Trump pushed did win.
Yeah, look, anybody who thinks that Donald Trump is not the dominant figure in the Republican Party is either a Washington pundit or a fabulist, right? Somebody who believes fantasies. Donald Trump remains dominant figure in the party. That's why Herschel Walker was the candidate. That's why a lot of other prominent losing candidates were out there, because Trump pushed him in. But here's the fundamental reality. Until the top leadership of the Republican Party, and that goes into the states and into Congress and all this, until they explicitly reject Donald Trump, as they should have after, you know, his recent dinner and all these other things, he will continue to be a dominant figure. And frankly, I've got a big piece in The Nation, which I just mentioned already, that looks at the internal dynamics of the Republican Party. And I see very little evidence that Trump is going to be anything but a major presence meddling in the states, including Georgia, for a long time to come.
I thank you both. John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. Wanda Mosley, National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can find the Black Voters Matter group at blackvotersmatterfund.org. And you can find John's work at The Nation at thenation.com. Thank you very much, and to our callers, for contributing to this morning's show. We have another week without Rose. She's on vacation, and we'll have a number of people filling in next week there. If you've missed any portion of this conversation, you can go find us at kalw.org. Thank you so much for listening. Come back again tomorrow for more of Your Call.